welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of ImagineUpPublicity.com, welcoming you this Saturday evening and every Saturday evening for education, enlightenment, awareness, and hopefully entertainment and fun on the issues having to do with the aftermath of crime in every way, shape, or form. And just to remind our audience, if you are a new listener, or fairly new listener, we have been on the air for nearly 3 consecutive years come February, and you can reach all of our archive shows at blogtalkradio.com in the Inside Lens group of shows, so it's there for the listening at any time, and also through my website, DonnaGore.com or ImaginePublicity.com. So with that little commercial, shall we say, I welcome everyone to the show this evening, and I am also welcoming you from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Delilah is with me this evening, so I say good evening, Delilah. How are you today?
Doing great, Donna. It's interesting that we're all 3 in South Carolina today, so welcome,
but we're not
welcome to our guests, too. Not even in the same buildings, which is the beauty of internet radio. You can be anywhere and put on a show.
That's right, even in your car. And we've done
right.
That before. Excuse me, I have to take a little water here. Tonight we're very fortunate to have a very esteemed guest with us this evening, and I mean that in all sincerity. Not only is he very schooled in terms of academia, in terms of his advocacy work, in terms of what he has been able to accomplish in legislative and political circles and advocacy in the greater Washington area. And also, I have to say on the air, thank you so much to S. Daniel Carter for being my escort and my friend when I was kind of at loose ends in Washington, D.C. in last March when I attended the national conference, and he helped me to put me together at Ian Seymour's house, which was an awesome experience in and of itself. And had I not had him and his coworker Marjorie, then I think I would have been lost. So, Dan, thank you so much for being my guest this evening on campus safety initiatives. I think it's very, very important.
Well, Donna, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. And as you say, I'm also an amateur tour guide in Washington, D.C. I enjoy showing people around, showing people the sites, and helping them make sure they get where they need to go. It is truly a pleasure to do that, and it was truly a pleasure to have the opportunity to meet you back during National Crime Victims' Rights Week.
Well, that's I think it's always a wonderful opportunity to have new guests about new initiatives, and this is a topic that Delilah and I have dealt with our colleagues, especially with Help Save the Next Girl, with the Harringtons and many other people who live in the greater Virginia area. So, again, I think you're kind of on the cutting edge of what's happening, so I think it's very important. It's such an all-encompassing topic, and it's hard to know where to start, but you had kind of given us a roadmap, and I wondered, to initially start out, how would you like to begin? Do you want to talk about your directorship with the 32 National Campus Safety Initiative, or what had actually been going on prior to you having formed that organization?
Well, I think just to give your audience a little bit of background, I have been working on college and university campus safety issues since I was a college student myself in the early 1990s,
right.
The boyfriend of a classmate of mine, a high school classmate of mine, was stabbed to death in the doorway of his fraternity house in 1988, and that was my introduction both to the victims' rights movement through his family and to campus safety advocacy when I became a student at the University of Tennessee myself.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I found myself doing was working as a crime victim advocate. And I had the opportunity to work with most of the families of the victims and survivors of the April 16th shooting tragedy at Virginia Tech, and worked with them and a law firm in Washington, D.C., which is now Bodie and Fierberg, to help them reach a settlement with the Commonwealth of Virginia. And out of that settlement, there were a lot of the individual victims' needs met, and that was important. But they also wanted there to be a living legacy for the 32 innocent students and faculty who were tragically killed that day.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that grew the VTV Family Outreach Foundation, which was initially funded with a modest but enough of a seed capital to get us off the ground. And the organization started in 2009, and I formally joined them in 2012. And their main objective is to advocate for safer college and university campuses and K through 12 school environments, as I said, as a living legacy in memory of those who were lost and those who survived the April 16, 2007 shooting at Virginia Tech. The program which I'm most directly involved with is known as the 32 National Campus Safety Initiative. We also are fortunate to have a grant from the U.S. Department of Justice's Office on Community-Oriented Policing Services to develop a comprehensive training curriculum for K through 12 school resource officers, which we are doing in connection with the Virginia Tech Center for Applied Behavioral Systems. We also have a trained crisis response team, so when there's another incident like a school shooting, we have trained staff and volunteers who can go in and provide assistance. And we have provided assistance to in situations like at Chardon, Ohio, and at Sandy Hook in Connecticut. We help.
Isn't that similar to the way NOVA operates? And isn't Will Marling on your board too? Is that right?
Right. Our VTV crisis response team was trained by the National Organization for Victim Assistance, which Will Marling serves as the executive director of, and he is one of the members of our 32 NCSI Advisory Council as well.
Okay, good.
We also championed the creation of the National Center for Campus Public Safety, and our president, Joe Samaha, serves on their advisory board along with several other key constituency groups, including the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators, the International Association of Emergency Managers, and the Cleary Center for Security on Campus. We've championed additional legislative initiatives, including the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, which offered much-needed modernization to 20-year-old provisions in the Federal Cleary Act. And we also provide remembrance activities. So we fund things like handbell performances in memory of the 32.
Mm-hmm. Is that like once a year, like a memorial service?
It's ongoing. It's ongoing. So it's several times a year that we have some type of activity, provide remembrance and support for the families.
Right. Well, are these all separate entities unto themselves, or is it sort of a consortium, collaborative type of relationship?
Well, one of the fundamental principles of VTV is we believe in building bridges. So, you know, most of our programs are done in connection or association with one or more other organizations, whether it be Virginia Tech, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Organization for Victim Assistance, the National Center for Campus Public Safety, which is headquartered in Burlington, Vermont. And, you know, we believe that building bridges between all of the people who have a stake in campus safety, it is really the key to success. That if you silo people off, which too often happens in advocacy advocacy efforts, government, colleges, and universities, you're not as powerful. We believe that you're stronger together. And, you know, that's why we work so hard to work with as many people as possible, including the 32 National Campus Safety Initiative, which has a multidisciplinary advisory council that guides us. So I think one of the master strokes of the families was after April 16th, they knew there were a lot of lessons learned and that there were a lot of challenges that had been identified in campus safety and really fully discussed for the first time. And they knew what the challenges were, but what they didn't know were the answers. And what they were able to do is reach out to other experts across the country. And that was one of my first assignments when I was brought on board, is to recruit our advisory council. So that, for example, we have Peter Lake, who serves as our advisory council chairman, who is one of the nation's leading legal scholars in higher education law with an emphasis in campus safety. Student affairs.
Jason Friedberg, too. I know
Jason
him.
Friedberg, the retired police chief from Bucknell University. And Gene Deisinger, the recently retired deputy police chief from Virginia Tech, who is the nation's foremost authority on their assessment teams. So we brought this group together so that we would be able to glean their wisdom.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, a very very impressive lineup of people that we do have. And so how is it going with your initiatives and partnering with all of these others? Do you feel like at this point in time you've made some major accomplishments? Maybe you can kind of go over that in terms of how is it going working with all of these people, almost like different pieces of a big puzzle?
Well, I think campus safety is a significant challenge, and we've had some significant accomplishments, largely owing to our partnerships. But there's so much more to be done, so much more work that needs to be done to really make our campuses safe, or safer, and that's the purpose of our 32 National Campus Safety Initiative, which is beginning as a series of self-assessment instruments guided by our advisory council of multidisciplinary experts across initially 10 critical focus areas that are the most challenging for higher education and have the most direct impact on student safety, campus safety, which is alcohol and other drugs, campus public safety, emergency management, hazing, mental health, threat assessment, missing students, physical security, sexual violence, and cyber safety, which is our latest addition.
So you have been adding categories in the process all along since you started this organization?
Yes, and it's going to be an ever-evolving process. We're not just going to deliver a series of self-assessment instruments, and that be that. As soon as that goes public, which we expect to happen in the first half of 2015, we currently just wrapped up the pilot testing process and are reviewing the feedback. We're going to begin again updating that information and adding new focus areas based on the feedback we've received for where the most pressing needs are.
And, well, when you say self-assessment, to me that sort of implies, now, are these self-assessments at any point down the line, are they going to be mandated, you know, like because you receive funds from the federal government, is this going to be part of you must do this or else, or is it just something at this point, well, this would be good for us to know as part of transparency or whatever, or as part of this, you know, being able to better assess what the needs are and each individual campus?
Well, what we found is that campus safety is one of the most pressing questions on the minds of prospective students, and particularly their parents.
Okay,
and,
right.
And there's a major incentive, yes, in part from the federal government right now, but also very much consumer-driven, for colleges and universities to be able to make sure that they are adopting best practices, pursuing
yep.
promising practices, and documenting that. And that's what the 32 National Campus Safety Initiative is all about, is really collaboratively working together, using consumer demand and empowering institutions to learn about best practices and empowering consumers to know the right questions to ask. When I, you know,
mm-hmm.
when I tell people that I work in campus safety, you know, still invariably one of the first things they ask me about, that means the blue light, emergency blue light telephones on campus.
Because that was easy to remember, right? Yeah.
And I'm talking about current students and parents who are looking at colleges for their sons and daughters still ask about that. And I have to tell them it's about so much more.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the major challenges is we've seen a nearly 50%, it's 47% increase in the amount of reported forcible sex offenses on college and university campuses between 2011 and 2013. And we know for a fact that, you know, the actual victimization rate has not increased 50% over 3 years. We know that it's due to the increased scrutiny and public attention and support being paid to survivors as they come forward. And,
uh-huh.
you know, one of the things that's important for parents to understand is that a college or university that's reporting a relatively large number of sex offenses compared to another institution that is not, is not the more dangerous. So that's not the right question to ask. The right question to ask is, what are their policies and procedures? Do they have the resources in place to support a survivor when they come forward? Do they have robust prevention education programming that is designed to change the culture on that campus that tolerates sexual violence, that helps train other students to be bystander interveners? So that
mm-hmm.
when there's a situation of sexual violence about to occur, such as someone who is impaired being walked up to a room in a fraternity house, that they're able to separate that person and, you know, say, oh, we have an exam in the morning, or to say, what about your car? It's about to be towed, or something to that effect, something safe, but that can stave off an incident of sexual violence before it ever happens. So those are the types of things that, you know, students and parents should really be asking about. You know, not do you have blue light phones and not how many forcible sex offenses did you have reported on campus last year. You know, those are the right questions to ask.
Mm-hmm. Well, I seem to remember, I know from my home state, at the University of Connecticut, there was some very high-profile cases, and Gloria Allred got involved in representing them, and if memory served, I think there was a settlement, a financial settlement, and I don't know, to me it was just kind of disappointing that in order to stave off or to fix things, institutions would rather settle monetarily than have more, you know, have it out there in the press. Is that kind of the trend? Oh, we want to kind of bury this, or we want to kind of get a quick fix here and get this off the front page?
Well, I think the real challenge is that sexual violence, and as well as other crimes, most notably alcohol and other drug abuse, are a challenge
yep.
faced by virtually every college and university in the country. I think the biggest challenge many of them face is no one wants to go first or be identified as the campus that has a problem.
Uh-huh.
And what we really need to bear in mind is this is a universal challenge faced in higher education. And I think more and more colleges and universities are starting to embrace and stand up against this challenge. And, yes, sometimes legal recourse is an option, but that's still the relatively minority of cases where there's actual legal action. And, yes, there is important rights under federal law, under Title IX, that sexual assault survivors can pursue. Colleges and universities under Title IX are obligated to remedy any hostile environment, which is viewed as a form of extreme sexual assault, is viewed as an extreme form of hostile environment, sexual harassment, and thus discrimination, which is prohibited under civil rights laws, specifically Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. And there is a private right of action. There's also an administrative complaint option with over 90 active investigations being reviewed by the U.S. Department of Education.
Over 90 right now? Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm wondering from the standpoint of, you know, once this occurs and it's high profile at a particular institution who let's say, has not been in the media. I think we were talking earlier, Delilah, weren't we saying something about, well, who is in charge and who has jurisdiction? Weren't you saying something with regard
right,
to
I
that
think
it's, in a battle?
Yeah, I think it's important for the listeners to understand what the jurisdictions are, whether it's campus police versus local police, and where's the intersection?
Right.
Where do they come together to put a stop to some of the things that are going on?
And what should we change about it if it's not the proper jurisdiction, or if there's territorial issues?
Well, the key is, as I stressed earlier, you know, we believe not just for what we're doing, but the solution involves, you know, a multidisciplinary approach with respect to sexual assault. We encourage colleges and universities to either have or be a part of a sexual assault response team, which is comprised of individuals from campus and local police, a sexual assault nurse examiner who would gather forensic evidence, a mental health professional, someone from the mental health or psychological counseling resources available on campus or in the local community or both, so that they can work one-on-one with the survivor when they come forward and get them all of the assistance they need. And this can be bolstered by mutual aid or memorandum of understanding. And it's something that under the Federal Clery Act, which applies to colleges and universities that participate in federal student aid programs, that they have to disclose publicly whether or not they have one, and if yes, what are the terms of the arrangement. So this is something that, you know, prospective students and their parents can ask about, is what type of working relationships do you have with local resources, and what on-campus resources do you have to bring to bear, and how do they work together? Because it really shouldn't be about a turf battle. It should be about people working together collaboratively.
Right.
You know, and that's something we strongly encourage and would encourage people to ask about.
Well, two things come to mind with me when you talk about this, and you're saying, well, their response typically could be, the institution would be, well, that's all well and good, but we don't have the resources to do that. And then the other thing that came to mind when you were speaking on this is all of these things are very important things that families and parents need to be aware of, and I think the self-assessment is a wake-up call for the institutions. But how would the general public, the masses, parents, how would they know to ask the right questions? Is part of what you're doing to have kind of a mass media blanket the information at some point in time and say, parents, this is what you should be asking?
Absolutely. One of the, you know, right now we're working with colleges and universities to help us determine what the best practices are and to measure those. You know, and once we've gone through that process, we will be also making the basic information available to students and their families so that they know the right questions. You know, we've got almost 250 questions right now just as part of our pilot that we ask colleges and universities, and I don't know that we – those will be made publicly available. I don't know that the average 17-year-old is going to wade through that many questions, so we're going to provide some key, you know, like a key FAQ, frequently asked questions, such as about the sexual assault office on campus, such as about whether or not there's a counseling center on campus. And you're right, Donna, there's not always the resources at every institution, particularly smaller institutions, to provide those resources on campus in-house. But there are community agencies, and the key is to outreach to those community agencies and make sure that when their students are in need, they are connected with those agencies. That's a part of what the Clery Act calls for. And, you know, making sure that there's that connectivity with the local community, including, you know, simple things like when someone comes forward, reports that they've been the victim of a rape, the latest amendments to the Clery Act, which were passed as part of the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act in 2013, require that they be provided with written notification of their rights and options, including contact information for on-campus and local resources. So they'll have the contact telephone number for the Rape Crisis Center. They'll have the contact information for the counseling center on campus, or if there is not one, mental health resources in the local community that they can access.
Well, I think that's very important. That's good. And is this, you know, going to be available on multiple websites and social media as well, do you think? I mean, is that all part of it?
Well, we have our 32ncsi.org website, which will be evolving. Right now, it has
very
basic information.
Why don't you give that contact information too? I'm sorry. As long as we're kind of on that, so people can know and can look and look.
It is the number 3, the number 2, and then 4 letters, ncsi.org. And there's basic information there about the pilot currently undertaking. And there will eventually be additional resources for colleges and universities, for individual personnel and officials on those campuses, as well as students and their parents and prospective students and parents, so that it will ultimately be a hub of links and resources that people can rely on for pretty much all things campus safety.
That's so a compendium of everything you wanted to know, essentially. Sounds great.
And as our advisory council chairman, Peter Lake, tells us, follow the science. So, you know, right now we're not just putting up the, you know, we're vetting everything that we're doing. So that we make sure that it's, you know, it's accurate. I think that's very important.
So these 32 are 32 institutions that have been very committed from the beginning to participate, right?
Wait a minute.
32. I misspoke.
32 it's 32 is actually in memory of the 32 innocent students, faculty whose lives were lost, because this is the living legacy in their memory.
I'm sorry.
That's what the 32 stands for.
How many institutions are involved in it, Dan?
We currently have 7 institutions that worked through with us from beginning to end to complete the pilot process. Had a few more, but it's actually, like I said, it's a fairly in-depth process. So, but the overwhelming majority, we had started out with about 10, and 7 you know, made it through all the way and completed all of the survey elements, did all of the feedback, all of that. You know, and that's the type of commitment we're seeing in higher education. I remember when I started in this in the early 90s, It was difficult to get, you know, people to talk about it, and certainly substantively.
You know,
a news outlet would do a story on crime statistics when they were first coming out. Talk substantively about the solutions. It really has taken us 2 decades, and that's it's really impressive that we're to that point now. I remember I used to have to, like, I felt like I was screaming at the wind. Now I have colleges and universities coming to me asking for help. They're hungry for guidance on how to best protect their students. They're eager to work with us. And maybe not every institution is that eager. But the ones that are leading the way are vocal enough, powerful enough, and demonstrate to their leadership the importance of this. The others are going to follow. And that's what we're counting on. The others will follow. Is there's eventually going to be a public recognition element of 32NCSI. This institution has, right now everything's confidential because it's in the test phase. But there will be a point when institutions that volunteer to be recognized are recognized as having been a part of the 32NCSI process. And a logical question is going to be for institutions that have not, once this becomes part of the public consciousness, is, you know, they'll ask other institutions, why haven't you been a part of this process? It's a free process that we're offering for free, and we believe that that's something that the market will drive. And certainly the federal government, you know, this is not a federal mandate, but that's one of the beauties of it. I mean, it takes a lot. Trust me, we're also actively involved in the federal legislative initiatives, and I've been for my entire career. Those are long, involved processes. You know, when they say act of Congress, it's no joke. I mean, it's a monumental undertaking. You know, we have the freedom to work with experts to implement things very quickly and based on the latest developments. So as opposed to waiting 5 years to get a law passed, you know, we can run things through the scientific process, which does take some time, but not as much time as Congress, you know, and get something into the self-assessment instruments in a year based on, you know, new promising practices, best practices that have been vetted through outcomes measurements and determined to be successful. So that really is the power of it. It's the power of science and the power of the market.
Well, you're right on the cutting edge, and that's you know, like you say, that's the beauty of it. You don't wait 5 years for someone to say yes or no about legislation, which is very good, because our society is so fast moving and changing, and it has to be. You know, an organization like yours is just, you know, the right vehicle, I think, for an issue like this. You know, and you know, I wonder, should we talk a little bit about Jean Cleary and who she was, you know, how that came to be, from the perspective of what her family did as a legacy.
Certainly, and for those who do not know the story, Jean Cleary was the youngest child and only daughter of Connie and Howard Cleary of the Mainline area outside of Philadelphia. And their two sons, Howard and Ben, had gone to Tulane University. And in 1984, there was a female student murdered off campus, Karen Menken. And when Jean's parents heard about that, they thought that it might be a good idea for Jean to maybe go to a And this was a family decision based on that, to go to a less urban environment, something closer to home. And she went to Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is about a 45-minute drive north of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
What they didn't know, and what really no one knew at the time, because there were no statistics available, is that crimes do happen on campus. Most campus violence is actually student on student. Certainly, urban institutions face an additional layer of challenges, but all colleges and universities are facing these student-on-student challenges. And on April 5th, 1986, Jean Cleary was robbed, raped, and murdered in her own residence hall room at Lehigh University. And her parents subsequently learned there'd been at least 38 violent crimes on the Lehigh campus in the 3 years
wow.
preceding her murder. They had been reported to the FBI, but this was in the pre-internet era. The Crime in the United States report was generally only available to law enforcement professionals, certain academics. It wasn't widely available to the public, much less a tool for consumers of higher education. And they started out first in Pennsylvania, and Governor Bob Casey signed the original state Cleary Bill into law in 1988. And about a dozen or so states were working on similar legislation by 1989 when it was introduced in the United States Congress as the Crime Awareness and Campus Security Act. And that was signed by the first President Bush on November of 1990. And it required colleges and universities to report 3 years' worth of crime statistics and basic security information. And the law has been amended several times since then, including notably in 1992 to add the Campus Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights, which was a measure conceived by Frank Carrington, who is widely regarded in the victims' rights movement as, you know, one of its founding members, and who was really the man who set me on my career course to be a crime. On my path. He was a mentor to me for all too short of a time before he was killed in a house fire. And, you know, and then basically the Clearys, through their courage, and they also had a settlement with the university that they used to basically to seed capital for their initiative. And they really were the people who made campus safety part of the national consciousness. Prior to 1988 and 1989, and I've done the, you know, news article research back on old microfiche and now on more advanced LexisNexis type searches, that's when the dialogue completely changed and it entered the public consciousness. Prior to that, people really didn't talk about it. They didn't know about it. They didn't think about it. You know, and they really changed the world. Mm-hmm. And the Cleary Act still serves as the cornerstone, really, of all things campus safety to this day.
Well, that is quite a legacy, and yeah, unfortunate that your friend died tragically. I mean, really, but that sounds like it. You know, this was the beginning, and you're on a roll, and. I can only foresee, you know, new and better things to come in terms of advocacy. Can we go over a little bit this specific victim rights with respect to when an event such as this occurs, whether it be, you know, sexual assault or whatnot, and what are their specific rights, just as similar to what are the general rights of someone who is the victim of a crime, and state constitutional and federal constitutional victim rights? Are they very similar or dissimilar?
Well, the Cleary Act, the victim's rights portion of it, because sexual violence is the most serious common crime that occurs on campus with victims, with over 5,000 reported in 2013. And we know that doesn't represent but maybe 5 to 10% of the actual number. The Cleary Act victim rights provisions apply specifically to sexual violence, which under the 2013 amendments include sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking. And there are a number of key rights that the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, also known as the VAWA Amendments to Cleary, provide for. The first of which is the one I noted earlier, is that anytime a student or employee reports to their college or university that they've been the victim of an incident of dating violence, domestic violence, stalking, or sexual assault, they are to receive a written statement of their rights and options.
Mm-hmm.
And those include the right to change accommodation. Our accommodations in changing academic, living, transportation, and working situations, if they are requested and reasonably available, and the student or employee does not have to report to law enforcement to receive those accommodations. Colleges and universities are obligated to encourage survivors to report to law enforcement and to provide support if they wish to do so, but mm-hmm. many do not. There's many, many social barriers to reporting. And that's one of the important reasons that those accommodations are available, whether or not the survivor reports to law enforcement. And the support in reporting to law enforcement can be to the local police, the campus police, or both.
Okay. So they have that option.
Right. And they have to be provided with information about the resources we discussed earlier, counseling,
right.
medical, victim assistance, legal assistance, and even options for changing, you know, receiving financial aid assistance. And the types of accommodations they're entitled to, for example, you know, if a victim is in the same class section as their rapist, they have the right to be moved to another class section. Or if they're pursuing, you know, a disciplinary action, they have a right to have the other, to have the accused moved to a different class section. If an employee who has been the victim of domestic violence has a known, for example, you know, known public working location or known parking space, and they're at risk from their estranged spouse or boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, they can be moved to a different location. Their parking space can be changed. Mm-hmm. You know, simple changes like that can save lives. And
yeah,
that really, it is one of the keys of this. You know, we're not talking about these overly complicated systems, and it's nothing that's not reasonably available. Mm-hmm. And at some institutions, that may, you know, that may vary. Larger institutions may have many class sections that someone can transfer to. Smaller institutions may only have one class section. In which case, other options such as tutoring or something else may need to be something that is considered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Well, like I say, I think there's so many factors that enter into it, and whether or not it seems to be when something is initially reported, a lot of the times the campus police, at least the local accounts that I read in my state, they were not believed. How do you overcome that initial barrier where it seems to be as if they are not perceived as being, you know, truthful? And I mean, I think it all starts from there. You have to take it seriously.
And that's why training and education is so important. There are so many rape myths, misunderstandings. People don't understand the trauma and how that
mm-hmm.
can be reflected in a victim's statement. That's one of the reasons, for example, the National Center for Campus Public Safety is developing trauma-informed training to be used for college and university disciplinary proceedings, so that when someone reports, and you know, they may, every victim responds differently. You know, when I was a victim advocate full-time, you know, I had a case one time where a sexual assault survivor did not want their assailant expelled. They wanted them to receive treatment. And the Office for Civil Rights went in and investigated after the person was found not responsible and determined that the fact-finding basis, you know, one of the finders of fact had based their decision that she could not really have been the victim of an assault because she didn't want her assailant expelled, not because her credibility, not because of anything else, because they didn't understand that each victim processes things differently. There's social factors at play. So training those...
Not one size fits all for any crime.
It's
not.
And training the people who are hearing those cases so that they understand, because someone doesn't want someone expelled doesn't mean it didn't happen, for example, is so critical.
Yeah, we just had a wonderful blog done by one of our colleagues, attorney Michelle Cruz, that and victim advocate from the state of Connecticut and Massachusetts, that touched on that very issue, that, you know, just don't assume that just because this is the way you think so you would respond, or somebody else, it may not be the same. And, you know, that is so true. And, you know, I want to segue into another area here. We have about, a little less than 15 minutes to go on our show. It's flying by. With respect to, I know that with the amendment from 2013, other categories of crimes, as you said, domestic violence, what we like to term intimate partner, violence, stalking was added. Now, Delilah, weren't we also saying off air, we were wondering something with regard to human trafficking?
Yeah, I wanted Dan to address what his or his organizations are seeing, or if there are provisions for students. What we're finding out is that there is a lot more incidents of human trafficking where people are being lured, you know, academically well-off students, in college age and younger. So how is this addressing this problem, or are the universities really acknowledging it yet?
Well, human trafficking is something that has certainly come on our radar screen, but it's one of the issues that is on our list to tackle. We have not had the chance yet. We're still working on our original list of issues. We're certainly mindful of it, and are exploring ways to research it so that it can be a part of the work that we're doing. As I said, we want to make sure that we do everything right. So, you know, it's something that will be part of our next round of research. We haven't had a chance to tackle it yet, though.
But have you heard informally, or just knowing from talking to colleagues, about how prolific this is and what the scope is, Dan? I mean, just in terms of your own feeling and what
that's
you're hearing?
One of my philosophies is that you can never truly take on a challenge until you understand the scope of it. So that really is the first question. And there's not yet reliable data on that, and that's one of the things we want to try and find out before we set about trying to find solutions. One of the biggest problems that I think we have, you know, even in our whole society, is people try to propose solutions before they even fully understand the scope of the challenge.
Right.
You know, simple answers like ban fraternities, ban, you know, drinking on campus, and, you know, things like that don't, as a practice, they sound tough, but they don't work. And that's because you have to have an understanding of the true scope of the challenge and the cultural issues, et cetera. And we definitely need to get a better handle on that. I mean, we still need better research on the scope of sexual violence and alcohol and other drug abuse in our nation's campus communities. And those have been known issues for over 20 years. The issue of human trafficking is very much a new issue, and we just don't have the data yet. That's something that needs to happen.
Well, we have a couple of colleagues that we can put you in touch with that are experts.
We would greatly
appreciate
that.
We do, seriously. And so we will be in touch with you about that, because I think that would be a wonderful collaboration with the people that we know. But my take, too, because I'm a fast-talking northerner, take-care-of-business kind of thing, and it's wonderful to study things and to propose laws and to do whatever, but I'm very much let's take care of business, let's be you know, one side of that coin is not only prevention, but let's be proactive so that we can do things to head things off at the pass before it gets to X point, you know. So with respect to that, I mean, we talk about this all the time in this show in terms of whether it's intimate partner homicide or people who go missing or whatnot. Dan, I always like to sort of end, you know, the last part of the show with respect to what is it that we can do to be proactive? How can our listening audience, as part of them, crime victims or their families or service providers, what can we do to be proactive? What can we do to make an impact now so that it doesn't get worse?
Well, ask the right, you know, for particularly for prospective consumers of higher education, ask the right question. Start to ask to see the annual Clery Act campus security report. But understand that the crime statistics and security policies therein are just the starting point, and that the security policies are just as important, if not more so, than the crime statistics themselves, because they are what tell you what the colleges and universities are really doing about the challenges they face. What type of mutual aid agreement do they have with the local police department? Do they offer a counseling center or a referral to local mental health resources? Do they have an office on campus that offers robust prevention programming and confidential assistance to the survivors of sexual violence? Do they have alcohol and other drug programming that is tested for effectiveness and consistency? You know, these are the types of right questions to ask. And we really believe that if the right questions are asked, that's the first step, to have the right dialogue. And obviously, there are, you know, laws that are proposed nationally and at the state level, and would encourage folks to be involved in finding laws that they support and work to help get those enacted. But also not forgetting that, you know, it's important not just to have a law. You know, I can give you a perfect contrast. The Safe and Drug-Free Schools Act was passed in the late 1980s and was relatively unenforced until recently because it didn't have a champion like the Clery Act did in Connie Clery, Jean's mother, who made sure that the U.S. Department of Education enforce that law. And there is now a Clery Act compliance division headed by a very capable man named Jim Moore, who has made it his life's work to make our nation's campuses safer. And, you know, he actually now has responsibility for the Safe and Drug-Free Schools Act responsibilities as well, really owing to the leadership he had on the Clery Act. But took the death of Christine Guest, who was visiting a campus in upstate New York, where there was an alcohol-fueled snowmobile accident, and her father, Stephen Guest, tirelessly for, my goodness, it's been almost 10 years now, worked to make sure that that law was properly implemented. So you can pass all the laws you want, but unless you have people who are active and involved in finding solutions. Well, you know, one of our mottos is, you know, VTV is about solutions. Compliance is very important, you know, and that's a part of our function as well. We do trainings on complying with the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, for example. Got multiple webinars and things like that that you can access that we've done. But primarily, we believe in helping colleges and universities and their communities find solutions to these challenges, not just issuing mandates. You know, that's the key, because we've been doing that for 20-plus years, and we still have these challenges.
Walk the walk, talk the talk, right?
Well, we're just now to the point where we've acknowledged that we have all these challenges. Now's the time to work together to find the solutions. And that, you know, and everyone has a role to play, the federal government, and they're starting to coordinate their efforts. The National Center for Campus Public Safety is helping to bring together all of the resources that they have, and bringing those together with advocacy organizations and experts, including the VTV Family Outreach Foundation and our 32 National Campus Safety Initiative. Incidentally, my colleague Marjorie Castro, who is our, who,
yes,
you mentioned earlier, has
tell
been
us about what she's doing.
Well, she's taken the lead in working with some of the right folks in Congress to get our family members in front of them, to get the National Center for Campus Public Safety funded for 3 times in 2 years. That's how complicated Congress works. In the recently concluded 113th Congress, the National Center for Campus Public Safety was funded 3 times. Their second round of funding for the current fiscal year, they still don't even have that money yet. That's things can get complicated when the government gets involved. But they
it's
were just
so
appropriated.
It is,
and they were just appropriated another $2 million, which is
really.
But, you know, if we leverage it correctly, it has the potential to do a lot. You know, and that's the type of solutions that we're looking for. And, you know, that's that many of us in campus public safety had worked on that since 2004. It took Marjorie coming along and, you know, putting all the right puzzle pieces together to make it happen. And now we're all working together.
Well, that's great. We applaud her, you know, for doing that.
And Congressman Frank Wolf, who is retiring from Congress this term, you know, he was one of our strongest supporters, and he championed that and made it happen for us. Can't thank him enough.
Well, I'm just perpetually impressed with all that's going on behind the scenes that we don't get to hear about, and that's why we like to have shows such as this. And, you know, my other question, and I don't know if we have time to address it in length, but if you have a friend who perhaps, you know, a college friend who has gone through a sexual assault, rape, or whatever, and the person for whatever reason is not reporting, where can a friend... How can a friend be the best type of friend in terms of being a resource or to help that person if they are apprehensive for whatever reason? What would, if you are a friend of someone that you know of this type of occurrence has happened?
In the brief amount of time we have, I would say the first thing is to believe them, to be supportive, and because we only have a brief amount of time, I would encourage them to visit the Serve Justice, SURVJUSTICE.org website.
Okay.
The nonprofit organization founded by the very courageous Laura Dunn herself, survivor of community sexual assault, who is now a victims' rights attorney. One of the key architects of the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, and who also does work with VTV. And, you know, that's a good starting point to get resources for someone who's been in a situation like that.
Well, I think that's very important and practical advice for people who may be listening. And would you at some point in the future when you get a little more data under your belt and other things, would you come back and give us an update?
Of course. And, again, I would encourage people to please continue to check out 32ncsi.org. We're going to be adding a lot more information there, even in the next 2 to 6 months. There will be a wealth of resources for folks. And also the National Center for Campus Public Safety. It has kind of a complicated web address, so just Google the National Center for Campus Public Safety and it will come up.
Okay, well, I think you have given us a wealth of information and kind of opened up our eyes to this issue in terms of what's going on beyond what's on social media, which is so much more important and accurate. And we do want to put you in contact with our human trafficking experts, so please do stay in touch with us. Delilah, do you have some parting things you'd like to say?
Well, I just think this has been a most informative show, and
I would encourage anyone out there who's listening to please share the link to the archives with other people, especially parents and students who may be just setting out to going to college.
Yeah.
I think it's the resources and the information that you've given during this show is totally invaluable.
Yeah, I agree.
And on behalf of all of us at VTV, our executive director, Alan Davis, our president, Joe Samaha, and the rest of the families, we thank you for giving us this opportunity to talk about the important work that we're doing in a long form. All too often, it's a 30-second soundbite here and there.
Right.
And, you know, this is a chance to really, really talk about important things, so I can't thank
you
enough.
That's right. That's the beauty of Shattered Life, Dan. So keep it in mind. We'll have you back. We'll have you back, and let's keep collaborating, and we can all help in this effort. So with that said, we're going to close out for this evening's Shattered Life. Be sure to encourage your friends to listen to it on the archives, and we'll be in touch, okay? Thank you so much, Dan.